It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. This just in, healthcare reform is going to cost money. President Obama, in a speech to the American Medical Association this week, said he expected making healthcare affordable for all Americans to cost, quote, on the order of $1 trillion over the next 10 years.
That's real money, even in Washington.
Although lawmakers on Capitol Hill are not laughing over the price tag, NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
Earlier this week, the Congressional Budget Office said a bill now being debated at the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee might cost $1 trillion over the next decade. There wasn't too much concern about that number. That bill wasn't finished, and the estimate was for only part of it. But when the CBO said a more complete draft being worked on by the Senate Finance Committee might cost $1.6 trillion over that same period, senators hit the panic button. Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus immediately said he'd go back to the drawing board to rework the measure.
I think it'll be under a trillion, probably just under a trillion, and it'll be fully paid for.
Baucus, who's been working hardest of the five committee chairmen in charge of the health care effort to find bipartisan consensus, said his decision to scale things back was based on conversations he's been having with his Senate colleagues.
I just think this, it's what the country wants, really, and what the Congress wants. I think that if you go over $1 trillion, it starts to run into some natural resistance, which causes problems we don't need to have.
One of those problems is the way Republicans jumped all over that $1 trillion word. Here's how Georgia Senator Johnny Isaacson put it at the Senate Health Committee on Wednesday.
If you converted dollars to seconds and you said, how many years will it take for a trillion seconds to pass? It's 317,000. 97 years, 11 months, and 2 days.
But while Baucus may be correctly reading the mood of his colleagues, they may not be correctly reading the mood of the public. At least that's the conclusion of Andrew Kohut of the Pew Research Center for People in the Press. Kohut says that the public is generally averse to massive new spending programs.
It's still very pro-free enterprise and has reservations about big government and big budget deficits.
But the public is even more eager to see something done about health care. And when he and his colleagues asked specifically which is more important, fixing health care or controlling the deficit,
a pretty wide majority say fixing health care. So with respect to priorities, the priorities with health care reform, not the budget deficit.
In fact, say some budget analysts, Congress could be shooting itself in the foot if it spends too little on health care. Jacob Hacker is a political scientist at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of the health care plan on which most of the current congressional plans are based. He says it is possible to do a plan for under $1 trillion over 10 years, but the only way is likely by doing less for those in the middle class.
That's a huge mistake because we learned from the failure of the Clinton health plan that you really have to address the concerns of middle-class Americans about the affordability and security of their coverage. You have to answer the question, what's in it for me?
Hacker also says that senators shouldn't be rattled by the size of the numbers because in comparison to what the U.S. spends now on health care, more than $2.2 trillion a year, another $1 trillion over the next 10 really isn't all that much.
It's a drop in the bucket in many ways. If you think about it, the difference between $1 billion and $1.5 trillion over 10 years is probably about a half of a percent of difference in growth in health spending over those years.
Or you could look at the number the way children's math and science author David Schwartz did last year on Science Friday.
$1 trillion would be enough to buy 1,000 boxes of Girl Scout cookies for every person in the United States, if that's how you wanted to use the money.
Now that would likely set off a debate in Congress. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Lauren Summers is the president's top economic advisor and Timothy Geithner's partner in creating the proposed regulations. Summers says they will change the way banking is done for the better. I spoke with him at the White House this morning. Summers brushed aside the judgment of New York Times columnist Joe Nocera that it is, and I quote, little more than an attempt to stick some new regulatory fingers into a very leaky financial dam rather than rebuild the dam itself. Not so, says the former Treasury Secretary.
Respectfully, the clamor of concern, particularly about the consumer regulation from financial industry lobbyists, suggests that they don't share Mr. Nocera's view. More profoundly, this is about reducing leverage, causing there to be more capital, getting rid of the gaps, and that's exactly what we're going to do. I think financial practice is going to be very, very different, and that when we look back a few years from now, we're going to see a very different American financial industry, and this bill is going to be an important part of the reason why.
I'd like to hear your thoughts a bit on what these reforms say about the role of the Fed in all this. So the Fed is seen as the best potential regulator of systemic risk in these reforms. On the other hand, under Chairman Greenspan, the Fed seemed to misread systemic risk terribly. The Fed had responsibility for consumer interests. You've now created an entirely new agency because of the perception that they weren't doing the job. Should there be more profound systemic change at the Fed to make it work better for us?
I think there's been a lot of soul-searching at the Fed, and that soul-searching will continue. I think Chairman Bernanke has different views on a range of regulatory questions than Chairman Greenspan did. I think the critics are right that an agency charged with maintaining the health of the banking system is always going to be prone to look out for bank profits rather than consumer interests, and that's why we've established a separate consumer agency. But our judgments on systemic risk reflect two judgments, and those who disagree should be clear about how they want to challenge those two judgments. The first judgment is that committees can't take effective responsibility, that collective responsibility is no responsibility or accountability, and there has to be an agency headed by an individual with responsibility for systemic risk. Second judgment we made is that if there is going to be such an agency, it should be the central bank. That's the way it is most typically around the world. More fundamentally, if you look at where the technical expertise is to deal with all the complexity of risk modeling and the like, it, in our system, is currently very much concentrated in the Fed. And it's for those reasons that we would look to the Fed. As it is recognized, the Fed's been a highly imperfect actor. It's made serious mistakes. On the other hand, I think it's important to remember that some of the worst cases, Countrywide, Washington Mutual, involved institutions that actually moved away from the Fed's regulation and were allowed to because they thought the Fed's regulation was too tough.
But if the Fed, as you say, has been perceived as being more interested in the soundness of the institutions that it oversees than in the interests of the consumer, let's say in the new world there's this new agency that's looking out for consumer interests, and it comes to loggerheads. A consumer interest agency says one thing, the Fed says another. Bank profits versus protecting the consumer. Who settles?
It's completely clear. On consumer issues, the consumer agency makes the rules and the Fed has no say.
Even if that would reduce the profits of the banks.
Completely clear that those rules are set by the consumer agency. No ambiguity about that.
Can trump any other regulatory agency.
No ambiguity about that at all.
So that's an enormous authority that the head of that agency
will. Very substantial responsibility. I think that's why so many consumer advocates are really hailing this step as an important step forward.
And you would say why so many financial institutions are upset about it at the same time.
It's also undoubtedly part of their concern.
As a measure of the success of this legislation as it moves from here into effect, how vital, how central is the strength and existence of that consumer financial protection?
I think the consumer agency is one of the key pillars. The elimination of gaps is in regulation so that we focus on the whole financial system is a second key pillar. The establishment of an authority that will permit resolution of a failed institution is another key pillar. So there are a number of crucial elements, but the consumer protections after what we've seen with predatory lending, subprime and the like, is really critical. So I think it's clear
for
regulatory system has to be changed in fundamental ways to protect consumers.
But one could also say the agencies had the power, they were captive to a herd mentality, or they were of a mentality that was...
I think with respect to the consumer, I think one needs to distinguish different issues, Robert. With respect to the consumer, any institution whose primary loyalty, whose primary test is the health of financial institutions, is going to look out for financial institution health rather than consumer interest. So in that area, that's certainly right.
Well, Lauren Summers, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Lauren Summers, former Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, is now Director of President Obama's National Economic Council. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Ever since February, we've been following Sylvia Martinez for some close-up insight into how the recession is changing people's lives. Martinez was a human resources manager in Virginia, but she lost her job 8 months ago. The last time we heard from her, she was in crisis.
In one day, she had been passed over for a new job, and there was a fire in her apartment building. Martinez was stuck in a motel, and she said she had little money left. She was continuing her job search throughout the night from the motel's business center, and a couple of weeks ago, one of those businesses called her and asked her to come in for an interview. Martinez agreed to let NPR's Elise Spiegel go with her.
For the last 8 months, Sylvia Martinez has worn the wardrobe of the unemployed. Every morning, she's paired bulky sweatpants with shapeless T-shirts and declared herself dressed. But not this day.
I had a reason to get out of bed today. I had a reason to put on a skirt and put on shoes, and I just hope that I'll be able to do this every day.
All morning long, Martinez had been telling herself not to get carried away. She'd had high hopes before, particularly with the last interview that didn't pan out. But considering her conversation with a hiring manager earlier in the week, it was just really hard to contain her excitement.
We had a really good conversation on the phone. It was really positive. And she just sounded just as eager as I was to meet with me as I was to meet with her. So
this optimism was new to Martinez. It's safe to say that losing her job had been demoralizing. So demoralizing that Sylvia ended up doing something she never imagined she'd do. Desperate one night, she swallowed a handful of pills. But recently, says Martinez, things seemed to be turning around. She had gone on antidepressants, and the pills lifted her mood and thankfully helped her finally to sleep.
Though sleeping has gotten better for me, but last night was just a little hard just because I kept thinking about the interview and what not to do.
What not to do. This is a topic Martinez says she's spent a long time thinking about, and it's easy to summarize her conclusions.
I don't want to seem desperate. I know that the last interview, I know that I seem desperate, and although I am by all means, but I don't want to seem that way. I don't want to come across to them that way.
There is, though, one problem with this strategy. Sylvia's been desperate for so long, it's hard for her to remember what it feels like not to be desperate. It's incredibly ironic, she tells me. For 10 years, her job was to hire people, but now it's hard for her to remember anything about her former life, including how to behave in an interview.
So yesterday I found myself calling someone that I used to work with at the last company I worked for and, you know, just telling them, what was it that I asked you, you know, how was I? Just because I have forgotten that.
After this reconnaissance mission, Sylvia says she came up with a mental checklist of things not to say. She was not going to explain, as she had in her last interview, that if they gave her a penny more than unemployment, she would gladly take the job, or talk in any way about the financial difficulties that woke her up every morning at 3. In fact, she says, she was not even going to mention being unemployed, even privately, to herself.
I'm not even going to think about being unemployed at this point.
You're blocking it out of your mind.
I have to.
It was with this stern optimism that Sylvia climbed into her Saturn view and set off for her interview.
Okay, so this place is about 40 minutes away, or?
About 40, yeah.
Once she hit I-95, Sylvia seemed to relax. For her last job, Sylvia drove this road every morning. But unlike the rest of the commuters stuck in traffic in Northern Virginia, Sylvia actually liked it. It was her time by herself, she says. And now she's back in her element. She is someone with somewhere to go. But as we get closer, this ease wears off.
I'm getting a little anxious now. I just hope that I say the right things. Oh, goodness.
Sylvia finally pulls into an office park and parks in front of a building. She's 15 minutes early, so she sits silently for a while with her hands on the steering wheel.
Now it's just a matter of just going in there. So, wish me luck.
Sylvia disappears into the building, a rectangle of brick and tinted glass. 30 minutes later, she appears again.
Hi.
Hi. How did it go?
It went well.
As soon as she got into the car, it was clear from Sylvia's face that the interview hadn't gone as planned. It turns out that the job isn't just about being an office manager and hiring officer.
I think they're looking for someone who has really strong accounting experience, which I don't. I did accounting in between bookkeepers, but accounting is not one of my strengths. As soon as they said strong accounting, I was like, ugh.
Sylvia says she was honest with them about her limitations, and the mood in the room cooled. They didn't even have a conversation about salary. Sitting in the car, her thoughts turned to her children. Two 19-year-old twin girls and a son.
I've always told my children how a college education is necessary, and they couldn't go in January because I was unemployed, and I have to get a job now so they can at least start going in August. How can I take that from them? I can't.
Sylvia says she won't share the details of her interview with her children, and that probably they won't even ask.
Chances are that they'll just ask how did it go, and I'll say fine, and I'll just leave it at that.
They won't ask more?
I don't think they will. Just because the last interview was such a disappointment for all of us. That, I don't think they will.
The unemployment rate is now around 9.4%. 345,000 people lost their jobs in May. It was the highest rate in 26 years, but many news headlines emphasized the good news. The rate of job losses was slowing. Things were looking up. Sylvia wasn't aware of this silver lining. She says that recently she's been mostly avoiding the news.
I just read somewhere that, I forgot what company, it's a really big company, that they're about to lay off 5,000 people. That means there's 5,000 more people that are going to be in the same situation I'm in. That's horrible.
She says she knows too well exactly what those people will go through. And Sylvia's own list of worries continues to grow. She has to reapply for unemployment at the end of June and says that money for antidepressants is running out. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
As the world of smartphones expands, use of that old-fashioned contraption, the home phone, is shrinking. Government research shows that more and more households are getting rid of their landlines, and for the first time ever, homes that have only cell phones outnumber those with just landlines. NPR's Tobia Smith sent us this postcard from the twilight days of the family phone.
Kelly Fitzsimmons did not give up her phone without a fight. The instrument of gossip and grand plans and the bearer of bad news and good, the landline to her was a lifeline.
I just had in my head, you gotta have a landline, you gotta have a landline. That's the phone to your home. It's home base.
But last fall, with the down economy forcing hard decisions, Fitzsimmons was finally persuaded.
There's the hole, the jack for the phone, and there's no phone.
They cut the cord, added two cell phones to their family plan for the oldest of their four kids, and started saving $150 a month. Today, her house in Harvard, Massachusetts, is a cacophony of electronic ditties.
Hey. Hello?
And kids in constant conversation.
Wait, I'm coming over to your house today, right?
Do you want to come over?
For a sleepover, right?
In like a half an hour.
With everyone now talking at once, what you don't hear anymore is the constant war over whose turn it is.
We used to, like, start fighting, like, I have to call my friends.
No, I remember the days when I was in high school, I had a 15-minute phone limit.
Hold on a sec. What gives?
That's how much time you're allowed on the phone. And when the sand runs out, it's goodbye, Charlie.
Would you get off the phone? I was supposed to call you.
The battles the Brady Bunch fought are as foreign now to the Fitzsimmons kids as the rotary dial. Mom says it was nostalgia that made her pick the most retro ringtone for her iPhone.
It's, you know, old meets new, I guess.
She says the biggest challenge to going cell only is remembering to carry it from room to room.
You just don't hear it, so you're hardest to reach in my home sometimes.
It's also problematic if cell phones are off or uncharged. It can be impossible to reach a house full of kids. But overall, Fitzsimmons says switching to cell has brought the family closer.
I do feel more connected. It's something I can just say a quick hello from work, or they'll call me too. They just said, Mom, I got an A on this test. So it encourages the communication. There's Megan. Hey, sweetie, how's it going?
The kids tell pretty much the same story, and they say they especially love getting a call at home on their cell.
It feels like special because they're calling me. We know that they want to talk to us when somebody calls.
By the same token, being able to dial directly to the person you want instead of going through a family line means fewer of those forced conversations. As one professor of cell phone technology put it, I hardly ever speak to my mother-in-law anymore. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
Whatever your family's technological issues, you can find some insight at our All Tech Considered blog. Go to npr.org/alltech.